I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. The governor of Ohio, critical to the Republican Party, is a win in Ohio. It's associated with victory in presidential cycles. The governor of Ohio, John Kasich, is a former member of the House of Representatives way back in the 20th century when Bill Clinton was president. But in these years, Mr. Kasich is an unknown for the national picture because he very carefully is leading a state that's gone from red to purple toward blue in the last cycles. Selena Zito of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review is here. Her essay at Real Clear Politics looks at Mr. Kasich and his presidential ambitions, question mark. Selena, a very good evening to you. Mr. Kasich, has he got Potomac fever? Does it matter? Good evening to you.
Hey there, how are you? Well, I think Kasich, along with someone like Scott Walker and Martina in New Mexico, I think these are governors who are excellent at running states and being managers and understanding, you know, that that's not always a partisan thing to run a state. And I think that they're looking at Washington, but in a different way through the lens of their states. So to say they have Potomac fever is a weird thing to say these days because everything is so anti-Washington. I think they all believe that they would be effective in Washington. Kasich's done his term in Washington, if you will. He was in Congress there from 1986 through 2001 as a congressman from the 12th Congressional District. But I think he is thinking about running for president, but not something that he wants to talk about at this time.
My memory is the 12th includes Columbus. And
yep.
One way of saying this is if you win Columbus, you might as well be president of the United States because that's where the country's going. So I'm not going to press you on whether he's running for the presidency. Is he set up to deliver Ohio? That would be a critical question everyone would answer if he one answered if he's going to be nominated. Ohio's gone blue and sharply blue these last cycles. Where is it now?
Well, it's interesting. Ohio has gone blue in presidential elections, very similar to Pennsylvania, but and Indiana as well. But when you look at the state politics, you look at the state chambers, you look at the governor's offices, you look at the congressional districts, those are ruby red. So there's this sort of, you know, I would say both of those states are a little more purple than blue. And I think that the Democrats really, really wanted this state for 2016. It was just incredibly critical to them. And the guy who is running against Kasich, Ed Fitzgerald, he's the Cuyahoga County Chief Executive, which is, surrounds Cleveland, has just been sort of an utter abysmal failure in this matchup between the two. He had to drop his first lieutenant governor. He's been unable to raise money, and he's been unable to get Democrats behind him. And it's not because Kasich is lovable. Kasich is not the most lovable person, you know, out there. He's sort of a prickly. He's tough. He's skeptical. He's bullheaded. He's also intuitive and deeply spiritual. But what he is best at is doing things, and that is what has helped him not only get conservatives behind him, but also Democrats and independents.
I want to mention Kasich's personality since you bring it up. My memory of him in the late 20th century is that he is easily irritated, and he's got a temper. Has that gone away?
His temper has gone away, but the prickliness has not. Kasich went through a really transformative time back in the late 80s. His parents, he's from Pittsburgh, his parents were killed in a very tragic drunk driving car accident. They were hit head-on in a suburban Pittsburgh blue-collar town, and both were killed at the same time. They were out to go get their morning coffee at Burger King, which they were both postal workers and they loved coffee, at Burger King coffee. And for, I would say, a good 10 years after that, he really struggled to control his temper. He struggled with his relationship with God. And he was not the best person, and he will be the first person to say that in terms of interacting with.
Kasich, we'll put him aside for the moment to 16 to look at 14. Tea Party. Selena, yeah. Is the Tea Party alive? Is it dead? Is it a zombie? Is it reincarnated flesh? Is it Dracula? Can you tell after the surprising win of Mr. Barber's win in Mississippi for his colleague, Mr. Cochran, and also what we'd have to say, the struggles of Tea Party in Oklahoma to overcome the Tom Coburn endorsement. So where is it now in Middle America, the Tea Party?
Well, you know, I've been writing this for a while, and I've discussed this on your show for a while. Political movements in our country have a two-cycle peak, and that's it. The Tea Party was at its peak in 2010. Yes, there are remnants of it out there, but people are confusing it with the sort of conservative wing of the Republican Party. I also think that the media has done an effective job of keeping the brand alive, and so have the people that make money off of, you know, Tea Party sentiment. But, you know, this is a very bizarre year. It's a populist year. But, you know, Cochran, I'm shocked that people are shocked that he won. This guy has been around forever. He knew what his universe was that he had when he was forced into a runoff against McDaniel, and he expanded it. He just used, as you said, Haley Barbour, old-fashioned politics. He expanded his universe, and he won. LBJ would have been very proud of him.
We're looking then at a Tea Party that has been sustained by national media, if I follow your telling correctly,
yeah,
and
absolutely.
Has not been able to deliver at the local level, except for that unusual victory by Mr. Brad over the majority leaders. Let's set that aside for the moment, because there were problems with the majority leader's campaign that may not have had to do with policy. He just didn't perform well at the local level.
Right.
The Tea Party going into 14, who needs it to be alive? Who gains from this talk about Tea Party this, Tea Party that?
No one. I mean, the inside Washington media gains from it. The Democrats gain from it. And people on social media that use it as an identity gain from it. What they're missing in this story of 2014 is that the passion and the energy is on anything that is not Democrat and anything that is not Washington. And it has nothing to do with the Tea Party or establishment or Republicans being well more loved than Democrats. It has everything to do with the six-year itch, and people are just ready for change.
Selena Zito, the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Let me think. Anything that's not a Democrat and anything that's not Washington, that describes a certain governor of Ohio. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Scandal weather in Washington. Just like severe weather, extreme weather, scandal weather is both an entertainment and at the same time hard to track. So we welcome meteorologist Francis Rose of the Federal News Radio, who is standing in front of a green screen to show us these various scandal fronts as they pour in on the nation's capital. We begin with the Veterans Affairs scandal. The Department of Veterans Affairs is making announcements of personnel changes. Happily, this describes the fact that somebody at the VA is aware that there are alarm bells ringing in all across the country because of waiting time, abuse, and mysteries of the veterans themselves. And also, what you'd have to say is the puzzlement of rewarding supervisors and leaders of the VA for misleading their supervisors and the public these years about wait times. Francis, a very good evening to you. Meteorologist Rose, the VA. You mentioned in a report to me that there have been changes at VA. Does this mean that people are actually leaving the VA to make these changes? Good evening to you.
Good evening. morning, John. The clouds are clearing slightly today in Washington over the Department of Veterans Affairs, John. The acting secretary there, Sloan Gibson, announcing that he's moving Carolyn Clancy, an internist, up from her role further down in the Veterans Health Administration to be the acting leader of VHA. She takes over that in an interim capacity next Wednesday. And he's bringing back a previous undersecretary of health at the VA, Dr. Jonathan Perlin, who will come in and be a senior advisor to Secretary Gibson as he continues in his acting role. So the cloud's clearing because these folks who have very good reputations, and in Dr. Perlin's case, experience at the VA, are coming into these roles. They're new faces in these jobs that have so much influence over the healthcare system at VA.
And we can presume that the commission, I note, is continuing to look for recommendations to the secretary and the president on all of new jobs, because there's going to be a lot. There are going to be a lot of changes. What happens to the people in those jobs? Can they be fired? Do they leave? Do people suggest that they find another occupation? What happened?
Well, Dr. Robert Jesse is the person that Dr. Clancy is replacing in that that interim undersecretary job, and he was due to move out next Wednesday anyway. So this is not necessarily a head rolling incident where Dr. Jesse being fired, Dr. Clancy taking over. This is more like a changing of the guard exercise, but it does come at a time where even the members of Congress who are most aligned with the Obama administration are saying, boy, you've got to make some changes here, at least for appearances, to give people some sense of that something is going on here and that they can start to try to put some trust back into the way they think about the Department of Veterans Affairs.
And a lot of actings this, actings that. Francis, does an acting mean that you can keep this job for the rest of the Obama term, or is there a time limit on how long actings can be in place?
Well, you're supposed to be in place in an acting role for no longer than 12 months, if I recall correctly. So no, you can't take an acting job today in June of 2014 and be there until January of 2017. These changes will continue. Part of the problem that the administration is up against is what every administration is up against at this point in time, and that is, it's hard to find people who are qualified to do these jobs. It's harder still to find people who are qualified to do the jobs who can get through the confirmation process. And then at this point in the administration, it's hard to find people with those two qualifications who are willing to come to Washington for what is, in the minds of a potential political appointee, a short period of time.
We go with meteorologist Rose to the scandal at the IRS. John Koskinen, who is not acting, he is the director of the IRS, was in front of two different committees on the Hill, both in the House of Representatives, and exchanging what you'd have to say were sharp and clever words about the investigation of Lois Lerner's emails. As I understand it right now, we're still in an investigation role at the IRS. Mr. Koskinen referred to that several times. The IG is investigating. There are several investigations underway. So we're in the fog of the scandal, Francis. We don't have any conclusion.
Well, there might be a chance of a thunderstorm over the House Oversight Committee after that hearing the other night, John. I noted to you as the hearing was going on, and my sense was confirmed by talking to some people on the Hill, that the Republicans on that committee came out of it not really looking too good. They were very, very tough on Mr. Koskinen. Some people say that the questions that they asked were fair. It was the manner in which they asked them. John Koskinen is a guy who I know and who has a very good reputation in town, and to just pretty much come out and question his integrity, a lot of people, even Republicans on the Hill that I talked to today, said that might have been a little bit over the top and may not have helped the cause of the people on the Hill that want to ask very legitimate, very pointed questions about what's going on inside IRS.
I note one metric. I don't know how to confirm it, that John Koskinen has been an active contributor to campaigns over the last 30 years, and the number was given $100,000 to Democrats. Fine, he's a Democrat. He gives money to Democrats. Is that unusual for appointees in an administration taking what you'd have to say is the role of the IRS to be one-sided in their contributions, Francis.
No, it's not unusual at all. In fact, if he were eligible for that job and it was known, it became known that he had given money to Republicans equivalent to what he had given to Democrats, it wouldn't be a consideration for the job. The coin of the realm in Washington, John, is money. And he didn't give the money, I don't believe. It's not typical for someone in his role, at least, to give money specifically to get a job. That's the old joke in Washington about ambassadorships, is that the good ambassadorships go to the big contributors or the big bundlers. But no, you could identify just as many political appointees in a Republican administration who happen to be big donors to Republican causes or Republican candidates as you can in Democratic ones.
Now for meteorologist Rose, takes us to the border with Mexico. The storm here is ongoing. There's a tragedy here. We have tens of thousands of miners who are flooding north from Central America, we're told to Reynosa, off opposite McAllen, Texas, to Nogales, off opposite Arizona, and ICE is overwhelmed. And we learn now that, I don't want to make a joke of this, but there looks to be some effort to blame George Bush's second administration for signing a law that opened a loophole in immigration. How so, Francis?
Well, the ranking member of the Homeland Security Committee in the House, Congressman Benny Thompson, who's been chairman of that committee, mentioned at a hearing of the committee about this issue yesterday that the reason that this is happening, the reason that these kids from Central American countries, not Mexico, can't be sent directly back to their countries, was because of a bill called the Wilberforce Law, was signed by President Bush. That's, in fact, the case. But what this is really turning out to be, it seems, more than a case of President Bush doing something that now the administration would like to blame him for, is that this is another case of Washington's law of unintended consequences. The original purpose of inserting that provision into the bill was for humanity. It was so that these kids couldn't just be arbitrarily caught at the border, put on some mode of transportation, bus or ship or whatever, and sent back to their countries unsupervised. You can do that in Mexico because the Mexican government has infrastructure in place to handle those kids when they're sent back across the border by U.S. authorities. The other countries in Central America don't have that infrastructure. When that bill was written, nobody anticipated that drug cartels would use these kids as leverage to either get drugs brought into the country or run money or any of the other things that people believe that these kids are now being used as fronts for. And so it's turning out to be more unintended consequences than nefarious activity on the part of anybody in any administration.
Meteorologist Rose, and the facts here, 2008, President George Bush signed the William Wilberforce Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act, and inside that was a project, Unaccompanied Alien Child Protection Act of 2007, by Senator Dianne Feinstein of California. And what she was, what the intention here was, that if you were not from Mexico or Canada, you wouldn't immediately be turned back across the border. You'd be taken care of in some fashion if you were a minor. That is the struggle at the border right now. Meteorologist Francis Rose of the Federal News Radio, in depth with Francis Rose. Scandal weather over D.C. High temperatures to continue. I'm John Batchelor. The John Batchelor Show's Best of the Week goes out each Friday evening. Sign up for the video shows at johnbatchelorshow.com. John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Tesla. Elon Musk's Tesla. Beautiful cars. I see them driven. Much, much positive information, including the stock price. And then suddenly an announcement that is surprising. Open source for the patents involved in some aspects of the Tesla company. Lou Anne Hammond of Driving the Nation joins me right now, and we're joined by a intellectual property lawyer, David Cabello, who is a part of the firm Wong Cabello in Houston, Texas. This is a intellectual property boutique. Intellectual property includes trademark, patent, copyrights, and trade secrets. Lou and David, a very good evening to you. First of all, Lou, I check with you. Did I say it correctly that open source of some or are many of the patents associated with Tesla? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John and David. Yes, that is what Elon Musk had said, that he was going to make all of his patents open source, and that's why we called David Cabello, is not only because he has been named the Texas super lawyer three times in a row in Texas for the intellectual property litigation. He also owns a Tesla.
All right, Tesla owner, good for you. And I want to go to your first thoughts when you heard that Musk is doing this, that Tesla is open sourcing. Does that make your product more valuable, less valuable? Does it make it successful? And what is the future for open source for a machine as gorgeous as this? Good evening to you, David.
Good evening, John. Thank you very much for letting me join your show. You know, I was quite perplexed and puzzled by Elon Musk's announcement, and I've done quite a bit of research to try to figure out exactly what the terms of making these patents available to his competitors is, and I haven't been able to find the specifics. The announcement would lead one to believe that the patents are going to be available free of charge to all his competitors, which, in my humble opinion, can possibly jeopardize Tesla's supercharging program. Tesla has these supercharger stations and a network of supercharger stations that it plans to build along the major corridors, east and west corridors, and then corridors running from coast to coast, so that the Tesla cars can charge within 20 minutes free of charge at a Tesla supercharging station. And so Tesla has committed basically to pay the energy charges for all the Tesla owners, and has committed to build this network of chargers at its own expense. And so to the extent that other cars can stop there and charge their batteries without paying Tesla anything, I think it's going to drive the program into the ground and possibly jeopardize the availability of superchargers to other Tesla owners.
Lou, I ask you for how the industry saw this announcement. It came, to my reading, out of nowhere. Are people gleeful at it, puzzled at it? How does Ford and General Motors regard it?
I don't know that Ford and General Motors are regarding it as anything that they would use. I know that General Motors had a group called Team Tesla, and they looked at Tesla, but whether or not they would actually use any of the patents that Tesla has, I'm just not sure. And David, to your point, when Elon Musk talked, he said all he means by good faith is that somebody can't sue him, use a whole bunch of their patents, but then sue us if they use one of theirs. So that might be something that he might be looking at, is maybe trading some kind of patent to use. But to the Tesla aspect of energizing the vehicle, John, if you buy a Tesla, you can go to any one of these superchargers. You never pay for energy again. So that's part of what David is saying, is that's where a revenue source could be in trouble. And one never, especially if you have a public company, you don't want to extinguish a revenue source if you are thinking possibly of the long term and maybe of selling. Would that be correct, David?
That's correct. And then certainly the other aspect is that you need to think about these patents as an asset of the company. And as a public company, you have a duty to your shareholders of maximizing the return on that investment. And so these patents are procured through great expense, and they represent an asset of the company. And so Elon Musk saying, well, we're just going to make them available, if they're made available free of charge, I would submit that there's at least a a part of that equation that's being overlooked, and that's the shareholders' interest.
David, is there an analogy to what we know of how tech companies have transformed themselves over the years by going open source for some of their material, by making it available to developers, by welcoming all comers as opposed to keeping it a closed shop?
There are several analogies. You know, for example, Apple has the ability to license what they call software development kits to software developers so that they can develop applications, which are then sold on the Apple application store. And Apple derives a revenue stream because for every application sold by a developer, the developer gets a piece of the action and Apple gets a piece of the action. And so that permits Apple to make a platform that is, you know, its phones, its iPads, its computers available to software developers. And it also gives the Apple users at least some assurance that those applications are going to be bug-free and virus-free. And so there are models which are synergistic in nature, not just for one party, but for both. But the analogy that I see in Mr. Musk is, and what he was trying to prevent, which I think is admirable, is to keep a network of superchargers from developing for Tesla, a different network developing for Fords, a different network developing for Chevys, et cetera. I mean, it would be similar to having a filling station where you could only fill up your Ford, and another filling station where you could only fill up your Chevrolets, and another filling station where you can only fill up your Toyotas. And so you want to have some standards, and we have those standards not just in automobiles, but we see them in the computer business. Wi-Fi is a widely accepted standard, and, you know, thank goodness we can all go to airports and hotels and everything and plug in our computer and have it run on the Wi-Fi network that was developed by a standards body.
Lou, is there any suggestion that this decision was made defensively, that there's something irregular that Mr. Musk was trying to answer with the opening up of open source?
I don't know if it was irregular, but I do believe Tesla is the one car charger, or uses the one car charger, that is not standard. All the other car companies use a certain standard, and you would have to have some type of adapter to use the supercharger that Elon Musk is using. And perhaps, David, you can answer this, but with BMW and others coming out with beautiful electric cars and plug-in hybrid electric cars, is there a chance that Mr. Musk may be trying to make nice with some of the car companies?
Undoubtedly, he's trying to make nice, but for the charging stations to work properly, you need not just an adapter, that is, to be able to hook up your car with the existing cable, but you also need the electronics in the car to talk to the electronics in the charger, because these superchargers charge at an extremely high amperage rate and a high voltage rate. I mean, I've plugged in my Tesla into one of these superchargers, and it's charging at almost 400 volts DC, at almost 370 amps, and that is a lot of power. And what happens is that initially when the battery is completely discharged, it charges very rapidly, and then as it approaches full, then the battery charging network has to slow down the rate of charge. And it's that electronics that is very critical and very important. And so just plug it into the Tesla supercharger by a BMW, unless you got the electronics to talk to the supercharger, then you're going to end up frying some of the batteries in the non-Tesla vehicles. And that's the part of the charging technology that's very important for the Tesla competitors to have and use if they're going to use the supercharging station.
Is there a profit motive here that it's going to drive everybody to get together with the chargers, David? Is that what Musk is anticipating, that it just makes sense to share?
I think the profit motive is that if Tesla's supercharging network is successful, mm-hmm. one, they get to brand all their supercharging stations. That is, they're all marked with the Tesla brand, and so you have non-Tesla owners stopping there. And then Mr. Musk can offset the cost of that network by charging the non-Tesla manufacturers to use his network. Now, we haven't heard anything about what it's going to cost, but clearly, if there's going to be a network in this nation of chargers, it would be helpful to have one network instead of multiple networks, because then you'd have a lot more along the highways that people were using or can use. But that profit motive can only come by extracting some sort of revenue to license these patents.
Early days in the land of Tesla. David Cabello, who importantly is a Tesla owner as well as being a part of the Wong Cabello law firm in Houston, Texas, intellectual property right. Lou Anne Hammond of Driving the Nation commenting on Mr. Tesla's unusual and generous offer to open source his patents. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Mrs. Clinton, Hillary Clinton on a book tour, Hard Choices, coast to coast, and especially enjoying the attention of the television audience, thanks to networks such as CNN. Mrs. Clinton begins her book tour, Selling Hard Choices, with what I'm told, thanks to Ruben Navarrete, a junior, writing regularly for the Daily Beast and a national columnist. She begins with a 73% favorable rating from a polling company, Latino Decisions. That's very high. We don't have to worry about a 3 or 4% error factor. 73%, very high. Ruben, a very good evening to you. Mrs. Clinton at 73%, what could go wrong and why? Let's go to this town hall meeting with Christine Amanpour of the CNN. Mrs. Clinton apparently did not prepare or did not have good answers to important questions. I'll begin with the question about the deportations under the Obama administration. How did she respond, and how did the audience, especially the Latino audience, hear it? Good evening to you.
Good evening to you. Good to be with you. So I think the best way to look at the totality of her answers, and Mrs. Clinton's answers during this town hall, was she tried to be all things to all people, rack up the maximum number of votes on an issue like immigration that gets you into trouble in a hurry. So as she was asked by a member of the audience to comment on the fact that Barack Obama has deported 2 million people in 5 years, more than any president in U.S. history, at first she starts off trying to apologize for Obama, saying, well, he's got a really hard job, he's just trying to enforce the law. Then she makes a turn and goes into how horrible it is that people are having their families separated. Imagine, she says, going to work and coming home, kids coming home to an empty home because mom or dad have been deported. That's terrible. We should not let that happen. And that sets her up for part two, which, you know, as we'll get to, was a discussion about these kids from Central America.
Right.
So the point is that she really would have come off better had she just sort of pick a lane and stick to it. But by trying to do everything, defend the president and bemoan the deportations, it got very confusing.
Mrs. Clinton is an experienced and veteran public policy official, and you note in your column, this is very helpful, 40 years ago, Mrs. Clinton, in the summer of 1972, worked in San Antonio. What was she doing, and does she speak of that moment?
Yeah, it happened during her time, obviously, before she started her career. In the middle of her education, she had a summer there registering Hispanic voters for George McGovern. She had really drawn on that a lot in her 2008 campaign, where she did incredibly well with Hispanics. People don't realize she beat Barack Obama with Hispanics handily. You know, 2-1, Hispanics
right.
preferred Hillary Clinton to Barack Obama. And I think what a lot of Hispanics have been wondering about and hoping was that somehow she would emerge as a champion for the folks who are being deported and set herself up as a kinder and gentler Democrat. Look, I'm not like Barack Obama. In fact, she's not done that, and she's come down in a place where she's disappointing many of her Latino constituents.
You have very serious stats here for someone looking to run for president. One in four Latinos, this is according to Pew Research's Center on Hispanic Trends Project, one in four Latinos know someone who's been deported. And you write as well, you know, attorneys, immigration attorneys who are struggling right now with the Obama administration. These are not fresh facts. This has been going on for several years. Are you surprised, Ruben, that Mrs. Clinton did not have a better answer? This, after all, wasn't a heated exchange. This was an opportunity to sell books, but also to present herself to a Latino audience. She knew this. Can we figure out why she didn't have better answers?
Yeah, we can figure it out. My own thought about this is the reason she didn't have better answers is because she has a political role model. She is smart enough to know that the best retail politician of our lifetime is Bill Clinton.
Right.
And she has the advantage of that. And she's not going to make the mistake that Al Gore made in 2000 when Gore effectively said, I don't need Clinton. He's a liability. And he didn't follow any of Clinton's advice. So she's gonna answer every tough question with a question of sort of, what would Bill do? What would Bill say? And unfortunately, Bill Clinton does not have a good record on immigration either. He is someone, Bill Clinton, who spoke to black folks and white folks, but never to brown folks. And in terms of Bill Clinton's record, you mentioned these immigration attorneys who every day go to court to fight deportations. Well, they're fighting the 1996 law passed by Congress and signed into law by Bill Clinton. So Bill Clinton has long been an immigration restrictionist, long been of the opinion that somehow there's a group of Americans out there who worry about too much immigration, too much illegal immigration. And so I think that when Hillary gets a question on the topic, her thought goes to Bill, and she answers it in the way that he might, which always gets her into trouble.
Let's go inside the Democratic Party's presumption here, because the Democrats enjoy a vast majority of Latino votes, cycle after cycle. Is Mrs. Clinton counting on that? And is there a sharp disadvantage to her stumbling on these questions? Isn't she, as a Democratic nominee, going to enjoy the Latino vote anyway?
Yes, there's no question. I mean, if you go all the way back to 1960 to JFK and the Viva Kennedy clubs and campaigns that were in existence in 1960, where Jackie Kennedy was going around speaking Spanish on television, you'll see that Latinos, the majority of Latinos, have voted for the Democrat in every single election since then. I think it's 14 different presidential elections. And even during some low watermarks, some really mediocre candidates like Walter Mondale in 1984, Michael Dukakis in 1988, and ultimately John Kerry in 2004. So they have carried water for the Democratic Party religiously. They're going to do it again this year. So there's no question that on Election Day, Hillary Clinton's going to emerge with very strong support from Latinos and the majority of the Latino vote. Here's the part that's going to be interesting, though. It's going to be a long, bloody road before we get there. And she's not, if she continues to perform the way she has, she'll win the game, but she'll win ugly. Because as they say in football, she'll win ugly because she is not comfortable on this topic and not fluent in this topic. And she's not inspiring confidence among Latinos that this is really a very complicated subject with no easy answer.
Let's go to the crisis on the border. The challenge right now to the law is in many pieces, and the Obama administration emergency measures responding to the overwhelming number of minors coming to the border and seeking to cross. This has to do with a mismatch of laws and poor information, but also the fact is that this is a tragedy. Mrs. Clinton knows that. She's on a book parade right now, not just to sell books, to present herself as a person who can be the president in the future. I am surprised that she didn't more carefully answer that part. Ruben, more than the other one, that part, because it's heartbreaking, and no one has a partisan response to this.
Right. This part of the answer really cooked her goose, more so than defending Barack Obama, which a lot of Latino Democrats will do, tongue-in-cheek. But when she was asked, what do we do with 47,000 kids who've come across the border in the last 8 months, and she said, they've got to go home. We've got to send them home. We've got to send a message to their parents that you can't simply send your kids up here and expect them to stay. We've got to send a message to all those folks in Central America. Here's my problem with this. You know, she's a real smart lawyer, and I'm sure they taught her somewhere at Yale Law School that there's something out there called a refugee claim, an asylum claim, that some of these kids may well be refugees or coming from, you know, makeshift war zones with gang warfare in Central American countries, and they should at least get a hearing and not be deported wholesale. So I wonder where it is that the lawyer became the politician, and we end up with a political answer. Something as simple as, if it's on a bumper sticker, send them all home. And that's really, I think, what disappointed many, many Hispanic supporters of Hillary Clinton, because she attacked a very complicated subject and oversimplified it.
Ruben is writing for the Daily Beast. He's a national columnist, Ruben Navarrete Jr., and he's writing about Mrs. Clinton's responses, admittedly in a town hall, on television, in a book deal, but these are rehearsals for the presidential campaign of 2016. I'm John Batchelor. These are the John Batchelor Show.